It's the seventh year across southern Indiana that June has been set aside as Limestone Month, a celebration of our area's limestone heritage. This year, Traditional Arts Indiana is contributing to the commemoration with the traveling exhibition Limestone Traditions, Stoneworking in South Central Indiana, which highlights the stories of the people working in the limestone trade. Exhibition coordinator Joseph O'Connell spoke with WFIU's Yael Cassander.
The exhibit is an overview of the different kinds of work that are going on in the stone business today. So that includes the whole spectrum from industrial quarrying and milling of stone to the kinds of backyard cutting and carving that people might do in their spare time or at their homes. And in the process, we're featuring the people who do the work. So looking at technical skills, life experiences, the place that people who work in the stone business occupy in a longer regional tradition of making a living from Indiana limestone.
Speaking of this region, this stone belt, maybe you can take us back just for a moment to give us a sense of how long this particular resource has been significant to the development of this area.
People talk about the limestone belt in Indiana, and it is referred to by a few different names, but I like the Salem Oolitic limestone belt. That's the one I've chosen to use, and that represents just a small territory kind of running north-south from Owen County down through Lawrence County and the Bedford area. So it's really a small area geographically that we're talking about in which this particular formation of stone is found that people have had great luck with using for architectural material.
When did people first realize what they in fact had and why it was so particularly valuable?
That was a slow discovery, in a sense, that started out in the early and mid-19th century when people were using outcroppings of stone along creek beds to build foundations for homes. And eventually they learned that this was a really excellent building stone, that it had a lot of desirable characteristics. It was uniform, it had a tight grain, and it's workable, but it's still durable, so it will stand up over time. The recognition that this was a really good building stone kind of led to the development of the industry of extracting and fabricating the stone for architecture in a more organized way.
And it gave rise to the skylines of our eastern cities. I mean, there's a mural at the Monroe County History Center which shows the Empire State Building rising out of a quarry from Indiana.
Yeah, that's part of the legacy of the stone that I think we've come to be very proud of in this part of the state. And around the turn of the century, for several decades, Indiana limestone was really a go-to material for all kinds of building projects, including some really high-profile ones like the Empire State Building and the Chicago Tribune Building.
At the same time, it transformed our local landscape. The whole locale was transformed, not only our architecture, but our economy.
Absolutely. The stone business has really had a defining influence on this region, the social life as well as the economy.
Bring us up to the state of the industry now. We tend to see quarries, some of which seem to be no more than glorified swimming holes these days.
You do see these signs of stone extraction activity as you drive around the region. You see quarry blocks carried on the highway on the backs of trucks, and you have some indication that there's still something going on here, and that the limestone business is not just a thing of the past like we imagine it sometimes. So there's still a much smaller collection of companies that are still extracting and fabricating stone, but it's a strong network nonetheless that's still very active and still meeting what is a considerable demand for the Indiana limestone as a building material.
That demand is from the building trades. Indiana limestone went to repair the Pentagon, for example, after 9/11. Is there common use for this material?
Yeah, absolutely. Public buildings are still a major factor in the demand and restoration work, like you mentioned. So the businesses that are around today are still quite active in building these structures that are going to be around in perpetuity at our universities and in our government centers.
What was it about the people working in this particular industry that drew you to a study of this nature? What is the range of people that you interviewed, and why did you think that they constituted an important group of people to gather stories from?
The range of people I talked to was very broad. I focused mainly on people who are currently working for stone businesses. That includes quarries and mills, people involved in extracting stone, people involved in shaping stone, producing custom cut stone for architectural projects. So stone cutters, planermen, sawyers.
Sawyer, now that's a word that's new to a lot of us. We just know Tom Sawyer. A sawyer is...
someone who operates a saw.
Sawyer, okay.
Mm-hmm. So saws would be one of the primary pieces of equipment that you would use to take a quarry block and turn that into a piece of custom stone for a building. Then beyond the people who are in the quarry and mill system, I also reached out to blacksmiths who forge stoneworking chisels. So some of the people who are involved in making specialized equipment and tools expressly for the quarrying and milling of Indiana limestone. And then craftspeople who do stonework at home and some of the local fine artists who use Indiana limestone as their main artistic medium.
Is there something about working in this particular medium that is native to our specific spot on this earth that makes this work different for the various people involved? Is there a certain pride or sense of connection that you noticed among them?
Yeah, I think most people who are drawn to working with Indiana limestone have a sense of it as something special, both a special material, a special geological formation, but also a special form of work and a form of work that has been a part of the social life in this area for going on 200 years. One of the people I interviewed, his name is Jim Matthews. He works at the Bybee Stone Company in Ellettsville, where he operates a saw. And Jim shared with me some of his sense of the personal interest in what he does beyond just earning a paycheck and benefits. He told me that working with stone is something that's in his blood.
So let's hear some of your interview with Jim Matthews.
Very rarely does somebody have something that, you know, that they do that lasts as long as stone does, you know. If you work in the automobile business, you know, it's going to end up in the junkyard. You know, if you fabricated stone to go into a building, it's going to be there a lot longer than the number of years you're going to be living. So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, the stone business to me is kind of like a person that's a timberjack. You know, nobody wants to do that, but if it's in your blood and you enjoy it, you know, you cut trees down all day long, climb up to the top of them, top them, you know, just have a good old time. Mm-hmm. And because that's your passion. It's something that you enjoy doing and you get paid to do it. So, you know, very few people, you know, have the opportunity to have a job that's also their passion that they can make a living off of and have the hands-on feeling of it and can look back at the final product and see the steps that went into it and know what you did and the small part that you played in completing the total job for the building.
Right. That's Jim Matthews, a limestone worker at the Bybee Stone Company in Ellettsville, whose story is included in the exhibition Limestone Traditions, a Traditional Arts Indiana project coordinated by independent folklorist Joseph O'Connell, our guest today on Artworks. Jim's family has deep roots in the limestone industry.
His great-great-grandfather was the founder of the Matthews Brothers Stone Company, so one of the early stone companies in this area. And he's still working for the same company. It's changed hands, but he's still involved in the same business as five generations of his ancestors.
That's so remarkable. And there's even a Matthews Drive out there. I think that's the address for the Bybee Stone Company.
It is, yes. He every day when he goes to work, he passes by two relief carvings on the side of the mill of his great-grandfather and I think his grandfather.
And that is a remarkable thing in this day and age to remain in the same livelihood and one that is so deeply rooted in a sense of place. What did you discover about family and community in the course of doing your research?
Well, the stone business tends to be pretty tight-knit socially, and that includes a lot of long-standing family lineages and connections within communities among the people who work in the business. People tend to know one another and to share a lot of occupational knowledge, a lot of insider understanding of stonework with each other. And a couple of examples of the way these forms of work are kind of maintained within families and communities are Reed Quarries and B.G. Hoadley here in Bloomington. And each of those businesses have been in their respective families for five generations. They're small businesses, independent companies, and they're really passionate about staying that way, about keeping the quarry operation as a family business and continuing to pass that on to the descendants of the current operators.
You spoke with David Fell about the origins of the Hoadley Quarry. Let's hear some of that interview.
My great-grandfather, John Hoadley, came over from England, Barnsley, England, in the 1880s, and he was a millwright by trade, and he was going to start up a grist mill. And so they had settled in Steinsville, or Gosport, along the river. And walking through the woods, he had discovered an outcropping of stone that looked very similar to the bath stone they use in England. So they started excavating the limestone that was easy to get to on the surface and used it for cabin and home foundations as well as railroad abutments then.
That was an excerpt from an interview with David Fell, a member of the fifth generation of the family that began Hoadley Quarry. His story and many others were recorded by our guest, folklorist Joe O'Connell, and are being included in the exhibition Limestone Traditions, which travels from the Mathers Museum to McCormick's Creek and Springmill State Parks to the Bedford Town Square later this month.
Another stone crafts person that I talked to, his name's Andy Morris, and he works for a very small company in Bedford. So Andy is, his father was a very well-known stone carver in the area by the name of Henry Morris. Anyone who has picked up Scott Russell Sanders' work on the local stone culture will be familiar with Henry. He's part of a legacy of carving work in the area that's really widespread, the influence of his father, and is connected to so many of the other people in the industry who do carving work because so many of them spent time learning from his father.
So let's hear next from your interview with the carver Andy Morris.
There's people come by who'd want a special kind of monument that they'd seen, you know, in a graveyard or something, and couldn't afford to do it in granite or marble. And we'd figure out a way to do it in limestone. And people want a bird bath or a bench. They'd say, well, how much is a plain, you know, bench? And I'd tell them, I said, well, what if you made it with this on it? Oh, well, this much, you know, more. And, well, what if you put this? Next thing you know, you've got a bench with arms on it, you know. I did one that had the logs for the seat and bench arms and a flat plank back, you know, used 1-inch slabs for the back of it. And, you know, you just you start off with one thing, and it's hard telling what you could end up with.
How do people know to come ask you for stuff?
More word of mouth. Yeah. You know, they'll know a cutter, and if you talk to them wanting, you know, something made, and they say, well, I don't have a shop, but if you get a hold of Andy Morris down in Smithfield, he's got a shop, you know, there at home, and he could probably make it for you. Things like that.
Right.
Just word of mouth.
Yeah.
That's Bedford limestone carver Andy Morris from an interview with Joe O'Connell, our guest. Conducting oral histories of people in the limestone industry gave O'Connell an appreciation for some of its nuances.
There's a fuzzy distinction between stone cutting and stone carving.
Uh-huh.
Because both involve the same tools, the pneumatic hammer and chisel.
Uh-huh.
And mostly the distinction is a level of detail and a level of complexity. I would say most of what people call carving work today is the ornamental features of buildings, pieces of stone such as the capitals that go on the tops of columns, finials, and these features of architecture that are very intricate and very ornate.
When does a stone carver become an artist, or is there a distinction between a carver, a cutter, and an artist?
I found all of those distinctions to be fairly blurry, and different people might talk about them in different ways. I've met people who might have begun their careers as fine artists and wound up preferring to work in the stone mills doing something that people are more likely to call cutting work. And I've seen the opposite of people who begin working with stone in the mills and then go on to fashion careers more as fine artists. So really the skills are almost interchangeable, and often the difference just seems to be how you talk about it.
Does Indiana and, for example, the Limestone Symposium that's held out there at the Bybee Stone Company, does it still occupy an important place among centers of knowledge and expertise for limestone carving nationally?
I think so. I spoke with Amy Breyer, who helped found the symposium as part of this project, and she has been a really strong advocate of Indiana limestone as an artistic medium. So its reputation as an architectural medium is quite well established, but I think it's only been more recently through projects like the symposium that the potential of limestone for artistic creation has really been fully explored.
There is this term that we hear in Bloomington, which is cutters, right? And that's a term that was first made famous in the film Breaking Away. But from what I understood, the term cutters never really had much validity. Instead, it was sort of a bastardization of the term stonies, which was a way that people from this area would self-identify, especially people working in the limestone trade. And then, of course, there was the picture book by Jack Welpot, The Road to Stony Lonesome. And so that term had a certain currency at one time. Did you encounter, especially among some of the older people you interviewed, that term?
I only encountered the term stony once. And the term cutter, aside from as a professional role as a stone cutter, I didn't hear about that being applied to people in stone business in general.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, Jim Matthews did tell me a story about some of his adventures in local quarry swimming. He was at one time an aficionado of local quarries, and said that he's swum in every quarry in Monroe County worth swimming in. And in that context, he did talk about people using the term stony, people from outside of the business maybe labeling some of the people who did work in the business as stonies. But he also felt that that didn't bother him much because the quarries, he saw them really as bringing people together and engaging lots of different groups in the same activity of swimming and really helping to kind of mediate the differences between them.
Let's hear what limestone worker Jim Matthews remembered about swimming in the quarries.
There was lots of times when I'd get off work, I'd be sweaty and have dust all over me, and I'd just walk up this old quarry road and take off my clothes and jump right on in. And of course, there was always a lot of campus girls, and they didn't wear bathing suits, so that made it kind of enticing too, you know. Because when everybody's naked, you don't know who's in college and who's working in the stone mill or who's not. And they used to call people that worked in the business stone cutters and stonies and whatnot, but I never bothered me any. You know, we all looked the same.
Yeah.
Naked.
Yeah. That's a pretty good story.
That's not a story, that's the truth.
That was Bybee Stone Company and fifth generation limestone worker Jim Matthews reminiscing about swimming in the quarries, as recorded by folklorist Joe O'Connell, our guest today on Artworks. So the stone quarries that have turned into swimming areas, actually, kind of illicitly, served as a real melting pot, almost.
That was the way he described it, yes.
Huh. So the word stony was sometimes used disparagingly by others for a certain class of people who were working in the stone mills and quarrying stone. Was it used with pride, though, as well? Do you have a sense of that?
I didn't get a full sense of that.
Yeah,
But I did get a sense of, in general, as I mentioned, that many of the people who work with Indiana limestone do so out of a certain personal passion for the material and for the process.
And so even those people who are involved in the really heavy-duty part of it, not so much the cutting or the carving, but the actual extracting, that's heavy industry. You got a sense that even those people doing that, or at least some of the ones you spoke to, feel that there's a difference between that kind of work and, say, construction.
I do think that in general people might draw that distinction, and that probably has something to do with the value of the stone and its connection to a longer standing aspect of the region that has really been a point of pride and something that has defined Indiana, defined the region nationally, internationally. It's a unique material, and I think people sense that based on the kinds of projects that it goes toward. People who are building with Indiana limestone are building to create structures that last and that have a legacy. And a lot of people did mention that as a draw to the work, that the satisfaction of knowing you're making something that's going to be there and that will outlast even your own life.
I know there's been quite a lot of banding together of folks in Owen County, Lawrence County, and Monroe County's chambers of commerce and that sort of thing to promote Limestone Month, et cetera, and on the part of artists such as Amy Breyer to get the word out about the validity of this medium. Is there a sense that this stone will sort of rise again, that it won't be just a boutique thing just for capitals of columns and that sort of thing, but that it will have its heyday again, that it will lead to the kind of wealth and prosperity, for example, that Bedford enjoyed at the turn of the century and that it doesn't so much now?
Well, I think as much as we would all like to revitalize the stone business to the level that it was in the early 20th century, the conditions probably will never be in place for that level of prosperity and success. But at the same time, I think it's important to recognize that the industry never went away and that it still has a strong influence today in architectural fields, and that is persisting. And as you mentioned, there's a lot of activity currently to really raise the public awareness of the medium.
To recap the idea of what makes this particular group of people unique and what makes their stories worth telling and collecting, what is it that drew you to them and their stories?
I think for me, I was really impressed by the central place that the limestone narrative has in the way that we imagine this part of the country, and that holds true in our popular culture, even through films like Breaking Away. So limestone has an iconic relation to Indiana, and I think that that was a motive to try to look a little bit more closely at what the present state of stonework in Indiana is, and trying to really get a sense for what people do, why they do it, and how that fits in to the overall importance, the long-standing effect that the business has had on the region.
I think it's interesting, too, to think about it in terms of our contemporary culture and economy, in which so many people are not making anything or touching any material, that we're all dealing with ones and zeros. So many of us traffic in digital technology, or so many people are, I mean, just in the news this week, they're talking about patent trolls, people who are not even making anything, but are just trying to gain the rights to it. So focusing on a group of people who are working in a real material that comes from right under their feet has a certain old-fashioned appeal to it.
Yeah, I agree. And that was a motive that people cited for doing what they do, that it's very hands-on, it's very tangible. And in some ways, it's a basic, taking large pieces of material and fashioning them into these specialized shapes and pieces. So in some ways, it doesn't get any more basic than that. There is a tangibility there that not many of us have in our careers.
There are natural resources that are indigenous to different spots around the globe. A lot of times there's a massive power struggle that surrounds those mineral rights. What I'm not hearing in this story is about a villain. It sounds very harmonious, and it sounds like from the person who's drilling out the limestone from the quarry to the heads of these businesses that there is some kind of equity. Is that correct?
It's really tempting to to view it as an ideal arrangement. And I think probably a lot of people do experience it as a really positive kind of relationship, especially working for small companies or working independently. A lot of people maybe start at big companies and then branch out and do independent work. And of course, like any business, it has its struggles and its antagonisms, but there is an element of maybe a kind of balance that you won't find in other industries that are more environmentally hazardous or that have larger corporate structures.
And you just wonder why, it begs the question, why is there not some big ExxonMobil or something that swooped down and taken over limestone extraction in this area?
Well, I think that's something that people like the Reeds and the Fells at B.G. Hoadley have resisted, and that there is another side of the industry that is more consolidated. And despite that, a lot of independent businesses have persisted. And I talked to David Fell at B.G. Hoadley, and his great-great-grandfather started that company. And according to what he told me, one of the reasons why they've been able to hang on and why a lot of the smaller stone businesses stick around is because of the value of the accumulated experience and knowledge that they share within their company. So he says that quarrying is something that you just can't apply textbook knowledge to. So it's difficult for a venture capital firm to just decide that they're going to move into the limestone quarrying business because they haven't acquired the experience to be good at it, according to David.
That is so interesting. And then, of course, if there's accumulated knowledge, the continuation of the industry is dependent upon the next generation assuming the mantle. Is that happening?
In some cases, yes. In other cases, no. I do think that as time goes on, awareness of the unique qualities of what local stone businesses do. That awareness increases, and I do think that supports some of the efforts of these companies to keep going and to find local successors for what they do.
Yeah, what an interesting story. Well, thanks for bringing these stories to us, and thanks for coming in today.
Sure, thank you. Happy Limestone Month.
Thanks.